Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm fine, David. Thank you very much. Also in Edinburgh.
Yes. So we've had a crazy past couple of weeks, starting, of course, with the death of George Floyd when he's in police custody in Minneapolis, which has spurred protests around the country and response by both police officials and by President Trump and the U.S. military in a variety of guises. And so we want to see if we can provide some historical context for all this. And in some ways, it seems like all of American history is the historical context for all this, because there's ways in which questions about race and state power and violence are all intermeshed together with all of this. And so I think we want to sort of see if we can disentangle this, in particular try to make disentangle things like the Insurrection Act that's been talked about this week, and the Posse Comitatus Act, and the long history of police violence in a racial context and what have you. Frank, do you have any initial thoughts on sort of what historical events have sort of jumped out in your mind when we're watching the news every night or in the morning and seeing what's happened the previous night?
Yeah, I mean, the past 2 weeks, I mean, we've been saying this for years now, but the past 2 weeks have been unlike any I can remember, just because of the pace of events and the scale and, frankly, the horror of a lot of the things we've seen. And I think in thinking about this episode, David, when we were talking in advance of the show, there's a huge amount to cover. We're not going to be able to cover it all, certainly. So I kind of begin with a preemptive apology. I mean, the obvious thing, I think, and I really don't mean to sound flippant about this, is the past couple of weeks really feels like, or looks like, I should say, some of the scenes that we saw in 1968, and we did an episode on 1968, I think a couple of years ago, but the scale and scope of it, you know, so the police violence that had occurred around the Democratic Convention in Chicago in 1968, there were clear resonances, at least for me, in some of the scenes we've seen recently, or the widespread public disorder and popular protests in response to the assassinations that year. So there were immediate resonances. Others went back to, you know, the 1919-1920 period because of both the flu pandemic, which we've mentioned in passing already, but also the kind of police violence then against and the Tulsa race riot of 1921. So there were various periods. In your own period, we go back to some of the violence and the state violence used against African Americans and their allies during the Reconstruction period, and even going back to my period when the first protests began cropping up about 10 days ago, and there was some property damage. There were kind of debates, if you will, or interactions on social media. Debates might be giving them too much credit, with some people saying, "This is un-American. This is terrible. This destruction of private property," and others saying, no, it goes back to the Boston Tea Party. And so there are threads that run throughout American history about many of these questions, and we want to look at some of them today. I mean, the thing that really struck me, perhaps because of my own subspecialty, was we had the event on Monday where President Trump and the Trump administration first cleared the protesters outside the White House in Lafayette Park to go over to St. John's Church, which is, if you've been to Washington and you've been to Lafayette Park, it's really difficult to imagine that space used in the way it was used on Monday, because it's such a small space. The walk from the White House, even for a rather portly 70 septuagenarian, to St. John's Church should take about 3 minutes. It's a very small area, if you know it. But that was a kind of crystallizing moment, I think, in a lot of this. It was probably the most striking visual scene since the horrible killing of George Floyd, which, of course, was itself very striking. And that's the scene that keeps coming back to me, which is why I think I'd like to begin with the blurring of the civil and military state power, which, you know, Trump was threatening on Monday. He's backed off a little bit in the past few days, in part because the Defense Secretary Mark Esper has sent out some mixed signals about that, and we'll probably get to that. So, but I think this blurring of the line between civilian authority and civilian police authority and military authority has been one of the things this week that's been particularly worrying, and that I think we can historicize. What about you, David? What's occurred to you?
Oh, I mean, so the parallels with 1968, or with police violence in the 1960s generally, I think is yeah. quite, pressing. On the one hand, I think you're right. So, some of the moments we're seeing are unprecedented. On the other hand, they seem like we've seen these a million times before, right? That, the George Floyd murder is, just the latest version of the Michael Brown version, or the Eric Garner version murder, or the Tamir Rice or Walter Scott or Freddie Gray or Alton Sterling, and on and on and on, even in, that's just in the past decade. But the ways in which there are widespread protests, the sort of the rhetoric about this moment seems like it is reminiscent of the 1960s. The usage of law and order as a code word for militant policing of black communities. The claims that the protests are being run by subversive organizations. So in that
outside moment, agitators,
outside agitators, and there was sort of this distinction between real protesters and rioters, and that seems very familiar from the 1960s. And Antifa, is being labeled as being sort of the real force behind the protest, which is. The same fiction that was existing in the 1960s, where people claimed that communists were behind, the civil rights protesters. I think there's some differences between the events today and the 60s. Some of the big ones, I think, have to do with the militarization of the police. We'll talk about that, I think, more. The police. If you look at sort of the police protesters, the police. Actions in the 1960s, the policemen are wearing helmets and have truncheons and dogs, but they're not wearing body armor, and they look very different. It doesn't mean they're any more or less violent. It's just the militarization of the police, I think, is an element. The inner cities, I think, look very different today than they did in the 1960s. The inner cities were very poor and black in the 1960s, and now, in fact, lots of these communities have changed in very important ways. The civil rights protests, especially the sort of ones that involved in the 65 uprising in Watts, the ones in Newark and Detroit in 67, the ones in the aftermath of the King assassination, were overwhelmingly African American, whereas I think we're seeing a sort of a racial diversity in the protest movement today. And so I think that makes it different. And the attack on the attack on the media today, I think, is very different. I think there was media coverage of the violence of the 1960s, but the cops never went after the media in the way that they have in the past week. Whether that's
particularly when they know they're being taped. I mean, everybody's carrying a camera right now.
Exactly.
And despite that, or perhaps because of that, they're acting, they're attacking the press, even though they know they're being filmed when they do it.
Well, and the press has been demonized by the president, calling them the enemy of the people and what have you. And so I think and obviously, there are far more media outlets today than there were in the 1960s, and people are watching in a much more sort of polarized way. When people get labeled as fake news, I think that sort of emboldens a kind of violence against the media that didn't happen, at least in the mainstream media, in the 1960s. All those things seem very familiar, but you're right, the stuff from Red Summer in 1919 and its precursors and the sort of riots of 1917 and the massacres of 1921, all those seem very familiar. Yeah, so in some ways we're seeing sort of a repeat of just the huge history of militarized violence largely against African Americans by the police and by other organizations of the state.
Let me offer, before we dive into this, because it's going to be an awful episode in terms of trying to lift people's spirits. This is grim stuff, but I do, in my more optimistic moments, and I've been thinking a lot about this in the past 10 days, think what we may be seeing, and I hope we're seeing, are the death throes of an old regime. And we might be at the cusp of a moment of revolutionary change. The likes of which we, perhaps last saw during the 1960s, or even before that, during the Depression. I think that's entirely possible, particularly given we still have the pandemic going on, and God knows how the outbreak in the United States is going to look after all these demonstrations and the violence by the police that we've seen, and because the grouping of large numbers of people together. So we still have the pandemic. We've got the job numbers. The latest job numbers are coming out today on Friday, and they're going to be terrible. I mean, we've got historic rates of unemployment, plus all the – I mean, there's a lot going on.
And an election.
But all this suggests to me that what we may be seeing is, as I said, the death throes of an old regime. And it's ugly, as these things often are. Revolutionary change is often accompanied by a great deal of counter-revolutionary violence. But we
In
may
fact,
be
they very rarely are not accompanied by violence.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So, and that is in no way to show a lack of appreciation for what the protesters are suffering at the hands of the police right now.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I want to, but I think in terms taking a wider view, that it's possible that this may be a turning point, an important turning point, and a turning point for the better.
All right. So, I mean, one of the things that's been defining, I guess, of the past week is the role of the military in all this. I mean, it seems as if the response is not just in terms of the local police force in many communities, but President Trump has encouraged mayors and governors to call in the National Guard, and if necessary, to call in, I guess, the army or something. And we've seen a huge military presence in D.C. How are we supposed to sort of make sense of that, Frank? We don't have a huge history of the U.S. Army being used against U.S. citizens, with some notable exceptions.
No, it tends to be used against civilians in other countries. That's another episode.
Yes.
Well, this is interesting, because I think what we've seen is, I think President Trump's, he had that. So in order to understand this, we need to back up. So a week ago, last Friday, were the first really big demonstrations in Washington itself. And there were some concerns, at least within the White House, about the safety of the president. And so the president, for a time, and we don't know for how long, took refuge, supposedly at the urging of the, originally it was reported at the urging of the Secret Service, in the bunker below the White House. This was reported, I believe, it's so hard to keep track of events, over the weekend, by about Sunday, perhaps, in the New York Times and Washington Post. And Donald Trump really got dragged on social media for hiding in his bunker and hiding in his basement. Of course, this is the language he's used to criticize Joe Biden during the pandemic and in response to these demonstrations. And so he really came out on Monday determined to be seen to be tough, because he's very sensitive to any claim that he's not tough. And as a result, he had a conference call with various state governors, in which he told them they need to dominate their states, and that was the word he used, dominate. And he also threatened to get tough if they wouldn't. And so, and he invoked the Insurrection Act of 1807 and said he would use his authority as president based on that act to send the military, not the police and not the National Guard, but to send the military to various states if these governors wouldn't get on top of things. And that was the immediate prelude to the Monday afternoon when he the Secret Service and various other police entities within the under the purview of the Department of Justice and sought to clear Lafayette Park so that Trump could walk over to the church for the photo op. And the photo op itself was controversial. Well, it was controversial in all kinds of ways, but from the perspective of this particular theme, because the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, who's a general, normally general, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff when he goes to the White House, is in a dress uniform, but he was wearing combat fatigues, and they walked with the president in this very strange photo shoot. So that's the background to all of this, but the, it all went back, at least in part, to his invocation of the Insurrection Act, which was of 1807. So I thought we could take a minute or two to look at that.
Yeah, so this is all by your buddy, friend, person, Tom. What's the origin of this 1807 law that the president is evoking for...
Yeah. Okay. So we actually have to go back a little further than that. But yes, it was adopted it was sponsored by President Jefferson during his second term, and we'll get to the context of that in a minute. I think it's important though to think about the legacy of the Revolution here, which is Americans during the Revolutionary era were very, very concerned about the use. About standing armies, as they called them, the use of the military in civilian life. And they believed that standing armies were a threat to the individual liberties of civilians. And that's why enshrined within both the federal constitution, but also the various state constitutions from the Revolutionary era, there are curbs on military power. Washington, as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army during the War of Independence, always insisted and always recognized the superiority of civilian authority and that the military, and always believed that the military must be subordinate to civilian control. And this is a legacy of that ideological tradition, which is quite important. The United States has a very small army after independence. And so in 1792, Washington and the Washington administration sponsors legislation called the Militia Act or the Calling Forth Act. And this allows the president to call out state militias, the equivalent of modern National Guards, the state National Guards, to quell insurrections and to respond to disorder. Because there are no police in 1792 or 1807 in America, no meaningful police organizations. And the militias, which are seen as in contradistinction to the standing army, militias are seen as places that as institutions that protect people's civil liberties. So it's a way that you can, because they're local. And so militias exist. The army's very small, and the Militia Acts allow the Militia Act of 1792 allows the president to call out state militias to deal with disorder. And in fact, President Washington did that in 1794 in response to the Whiskey Rebellion, among other things. Sure. So we go forward to 1807. So that's how things stand in the early Republic. And they more or less work. It's really important, though, and we've talked about this before, to bear in mind state militias are important not only for maintaining order, but also for appropriating lands from Native Americans, and in the southern slave states in particular, as far as preventing slave insurrections as well. So the biggest arm of state coercion at the turn of the 19th century in the United States are probably state militias. In the 1807 Insurrection Act, President Jefferson had that proposed by one of his allies in Congress, and the Insurrection Act allows for the use of federal troops to suppress insurrections within the United States. So this explicitly allows the president, under certain circumstances, to use the United States Army or other arms of the United States military to suppress insurrections within the United States. So this is a break with precedent. And this was adopted in March of 1807, and it's a response to the Burr conspiracy. we should do an episode on the Burr conspiracy sometime because it's nuts. Aaron Burr, Aaron Burr had been the president, vice president of the United States. Aaron Burr was a prominent politician. He was a Revolutionary War veteran. He ended up being Jefferson's vice president after the tangled election of 1800, which is again in a whole nother story we should talk about sometime. There's all kinds of shenanigans around the election of 1800. Burr at one point, because that election was tied in the Electoral College and thrown to the House of Representatives. And so Burr and Jefferson both finished on the same number of electoral votes. Burr entertained the idea, at least, of becoming president during the 1800-1801 electoral dispute. He did not become president, so he served as Jefferson's vice president. He killed Alexander Hamilton in 1804 in a duel. By 1806, 1807, he's out of office. He's disgraced, and he's wandering around what was then the American West, what's now modern kind of Ohio, and then Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, and what was then known as the Southwest. And he's doing something. We don't know exactly what he was doing. His argument is he was seeking to put together a military force to liberate Spanish territory west of the Mississippi River. Jefferson's fear was that Burr was putting together a conspiracy to create a Western Confederacy that was going to secede from the United States. There's evidence to support both claims. It's not entirely clear. He's up to no good in 1806, 1807. Hmm. And Jefferson, who has no time at all, I mean, Jefferson hates Aaron Burr. Jefferson, this is the key background to his sponsorship of the and signing of the Insurrection Act of 1807. I've seen some commentary in recent days saying, no, this was about slavery. I don't actually adhere to that view. I mean, the coercive power of the state is actually well established to deal with slavery in this period. If one only has to look at the aftermath of Gabriel's Rebellion in Virginia in 1801, 1802, and you know, to see that. So I don't think that this particular act is about slavery, but it's about Jefferson trying to marshal the power of the state to go after Aaron Burr because he believes that Burr's conspiracy is real. And he's not entirely sure that he can rely on the local militia in places like Tennessee and Kentucky, who he fears might be sympathetic to Burr. So that's the immediate background. Sorry, go ahead.
One thing that strikes me about that context is, you know, the it seems as if in the early Republic, the president is both apprehensive about using the military, but also willing to use the military for essentially police action in the absence of any actual police force at the local level. Right, so I think, you know, what connects the Whiskey Rebellion, you know, prior to the Insurrection Act, and then sort of the period you're talking about, a decade or so later, is that there isn't a local police, there isn't a national police, but there is, you know, the small U.S. Army, and there are militias that can be sort of called into action. Which is very different, I think, than obviously where we are today.
That's right. I mean, you and I were talking off air, David. I mean, one of the reasons – I mean, this is interesting stuff, and the story of the Burr conspiracy is fascinating, et cetera, at least to me. But the world is so different. So these are people with muskets, for one thing, and the numbers are very small. I mean, I reckon that the average suburban police department in any of the – in a decent-sized jurisdiction in the United States, you know – would have enough firepower to defeat the United States Army of 1807 pretty easily.
Yes, I think that's
so we're not dealing with let alone the New York Police Department with its 40,000 officers.
Yes.
You know, we're just not dealing with we're not comparing like for like here. But the ideological inheritance is important because it's a really important it provides important context. You know, the Second Amendment, which we have talked about in the past, is about people defending themselves because of the fear of standing armies. And so, you know, we've seen some people, you know, exercising their Second Amendment rights, inevitably white people, in the past week or so, you know, in support of the police.
And President Trump mentioned it, you know, in that weird speech before he marched over to the church. He mentioned, using the military. Andy mentioned people defend using their Second Amendment rights, which is a kind of a you know, you can read that in a variety of ways, yeah. but one way to read that is inciting people to violence.
Yeah, but what I guess the point is we're not talking about, you know, their world and our world are not the same. So I think this is important context, especially for the ideological assumptions. But I, you know, it only takes us so far, I suppose. And I guess we have to look forward. So the Insurrection Act has been used a couple of times. It was used a number of times in the early 19th century. But it was used most recently, interestingly, by George H.W. Bush in response to the demonstrations and the disorder after the Rodney King verdict in California in 1992. But that was interesting because the governor of California requested the federal troops at that point. And that was germane a little bit to our current discussion, I think, because that was an election year as well. And the first President Bush wanted to demonstrate he was tough and stood for law and order. And so to some extent, the evidence seemed to suggest that he encouraged the governor of California to ask for the help. That hasn't happened in this case. No state governor has asked for, at least to my knowledge, none of the state, and certainly the authorities in Washington, D.C. haven't asked for federal troops to come.
That's right.
So, David, if you go forward to the 19th century, because there's an important kind of correlator to all this, which is from your period, which is the Posse Comitatus Act. Can you say something about that?
Yes. So in some ways, the Posse Comitatus Act and the Insurrection Act sort of act in tandem with each other, and they sort of regulate between them the ways in which federal military power can be used in a policing role. And sort of the background to it, there's sort of two key elements that sort of led to its passage. One is the end of Reconstruction, at least the way that we tend to chronologize Reconstruction, in which, you know, the U.S. Army had been used during the Civil War and during Reconstruction as a police force in a variety of ways. You know, the constitutional rationale of the Lincoln administration during the war was that the insurrection was that the Confederacy was unconstitutional, that secession was illegal. And you have an insurrection, then the army is putting down an insurrection, and that you find the army being used in a similar function during Reconstruction, fighting against, among other groups, like the Klan, and you have President Grant doing that as part of the sort of the walk back from Reconstruction and the Compromise of 1877 and all that. One of the agreements that's reached between Republicans and Southern Democrats is the removal of military force, what's left of military force from the South. And part of what white Southerners wanted was the ability to maintain local policing, which is to say maintain a sort of white supremacist local policing without the interference of the federal government. So they're in favor of limiting the power of the military. The other thing that happened that sort of leads to its passage is the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. This is in the midst of an economic crisis. There's an enormous labor uprising, and the army is used often quite violently to break up the National Railroad strike. And sort of the confluence of these two, in some ways actually quite disparate political forces, white Southern Democrats and Northern, both Democrats and Republicans, who are responding to the Great Railroad Strike, lead to the passage of the Posse Comitatus Act, which says that the army cannot be used to do run-of-the-mill kinds of policing. There's exceptions, and there's been the law has been modified in a variety of ways since then, but it's prohibits the federal government from using the army to engage in regular law enforcement. There's some exceptions. The It doesn't apply to the National Guard, which is its own separate branch of the military. It applies to the Army and the Air Force. Technically doesn't apply to the Navy, although the Navy says they're not going to be engaging in domestic law enforcement. It's unclear whether it applies to the new Space Force. Presumably they're not going to be deeply involved in domestic law enforcement, but the National Guard is one of the groups in the federal military, and the National Guard is obviously in this weird hybrid situation where it's responsible not only to the federal government, also to state governors.
Sorry, David, can I interrupt you just briefly to make one quick observation, which is the exclusion of the Navy is very interesting because, again, we're back to this 18th century inheritance from Britain. So American Whigs and British Whigs, in fact, in the 18th century, who were skeptical about state power and especially skeptical about standing armies, excluded navies because they believed the Royal Navy, for example, was a bulwark of British liberty, as opposed to the army, which was seen as a threat. Because, of course, the army is stationed among civilians. The army is used against civilians in a way that the Navy isn't, at least so they believe. It's an interesting distinction. So there is a slight difference in how in this ideological inheritance or distinction that's made between how the army is seen, a standing army as a threat, whereas a navy is not seen as threatening.
And it's interesting because, I mean, it doesn't get used all that often, but there are times, even in recent history, when the Posse Comitatus Act gets employed. I mean, there was a case in 2009 which some military police in Alabama intervened in some local law enforcement, and they got punished for it because they were sort of overstepping the bounds of the distinction between civilian police and military police. But I think sort of the premise is that in the general situations, the U.S. military is not supposed to be used for crowd control. It's not supposed to be used for the kinds of actions we've seen in the past week.
Well, it's not a law enforcement organization for a start.
And they're not trained to do law enforcement.
That's right. That's right. There's a sharp distinction that many in the military, and that's been expressed this week by others, who pushed back from within the military about their use or the threat to use them in this way. So there's which brings us to the police. How do we end up with the police as they are, David?
Well, I mean, I guess one could argue that the police in the United States historically have always engaged in been an agent of structural racism from the very beginning. Which is not to say that police are racist. It's saying that I think that the institutions that they're built upon have been and to some degree still are, and obviously the recent weeks suggest this, I have racist underpinnings. If we think about where policing begins in the United States, there's sort of like two origins of American policing. One is in slave patrols, that is to say the regulatory entities that are created in the American South to control enslaved populations, to prevent enslaved people from running away, from regulating their movements at night. And these are, in many ways, the first professional police forces that exist in the United States. And they are created drawing upon white people, both slave owners and non-slaveholders, empowering them to engage in violence against African Americans with the authority of the state behind them. And one can draw it's not quite a straight line, but only slightly wiggly line between the structures of slave patrols in the antebellum period through to police forces you know, after emancipation and to the police forces today. In the North, I mean, you don't have a police force during your period, really, you know, and policing begins in the United States later than in lots of countries. You know, it comes after policing gets established in the UK, for instance. And it's not really until the 1840s and 1850s that you start to find local communities in the North establishing professional police forces. They are in response, in some ways, to the protests that emerge from the Panic of 1837. There are a series of working class uprisings. Ones, as they're often called, riots. I'm very hesitant to use the word riot because riot is often a term that's used to sort of justify police and state violence. But there's a series of protests in the 1840s by working class people, and police forces starting in Philadelphia and New York are created to regulate those. And so it's about not so much about stopping crime as it is about regulating the poor, if that distinction means anything. You know, one of the interesting features of policing in the North, at least in the 19th century, is that policing is very much built upon patronage, and that getting a job in the police force was about pledging your vote to a particular candidate. You know, so it wasn't built on a professional model. It was built on the kind of machine politics that dominated northern cities throughout the middle part of the 19th century and into the 20th century. And that was largely about, you know, creating and legitimizing sort of the state use of force, but it was also about sort of legitimizing different immigrant populations. You find immigrant communities becoming American through the police force. You find that with Irish immigrants. You find that with Italian immigrants in major cities. But, you know, I think the policing we are having today is sort of rooted in and I'm drawing here a lot on the work of Khalil Muhammad at Harvard, who has written really extensively about the origins of American policing and its sort of role in the 20th century. You know, the sort of 19th century origins of American policing become professionalized in the 20th century in pretty powerful ways. But they draw upon, you know, racist science to argue that African Americans are inherently criminal, and that sort of justifies hyper policing of black communities, and you see that in really throughout the 20th century in different guises. You know, and what we find is that the more heavily communities are policed, you know, the more that, you know, these kinds of racial disparities and class disparities get sort of reinscribed in the system. People with criminal records don't get jobs, you know, and sort of the animosity that develops between communities and the police forces that are regulating them, you know, is only, you know, really throughout the most of American history has been profound. Yeah. I don't know. I'm almost at a loss for words about how to sort of think about.
Hold on, that's you at a loss for words.
Well, I'm deeply, you know, frustrated and angry at sort of just what I see on the news every night before I go to bed. When I wake up in the morning, and there's a new set of horrific images to sort of process. And you know, one of the things that we have heard from police forces, and we heard this in the 1960s, and we heard it after the Rodney King riots in 1992, if riot is the right word there, And we heard it recently, you know, after Ferguson, that the police would somehow reform themselves. You know, there were people saying, "Oh, maybe body cameras are going to fix the problems with policing in the United States." And I'm not. I'm just not quite sure what a solution looks like at this point.
Well, I think I mean, one of the things for a start is we have to demilitarize the police. So it's, you know, one of the things that's really emerged really since 9/11, with the massive military buildup we've had since 9/11, is the military has sort of passed down its hand-me-downs to local police forces, either giving them equipment or selling them equipment. Surplus equipment. And so we've seen police forces that really do look like armies. So this notion that we began with about a distinction between kind of civilian authority and military authority has been blurred when one looks at the police, modern police forces in the United States. There are 18,000 police forces in the United States, and most of them are kitted out like military units now. In terms of the way they dress, the appearance, and the equipment they've got. And it's, I heard a figure earlier in the week, and I wish I could cite it accurately and cite the source. So this is, I'm pulling this from my memory, so please forgive me. But something like 95% of all arrests involve nonviolent crimes and nonviolent people. So we do not need police to be as heavily armed as they are. And it seems to me there's been a crucial development in the past 20 years, not for the better. So the things you've discussed, David, are all true, and these historic legacies are important to be aware of. But I think if we don't equip the police in the way we do, and this is difficult to argue against, because people would say, well, aren't you in favor of law and order? Don't you want to protect policemen and women? And of course you want to, you know, provide them with equipment to do their jobs. But as the saying goes, when all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So if you're dressed like an army of occupation, you're going to behave like an army of occupation, particularly now that increasingly police forces and the people who make up police forces don't live in the communities they're policing. So I think there's a kind of cultural shift that needs to be made, but it would begin there. Making sure that there's civilian oversight of the police. I think we almost need to treat the police like they're the military until they stop acting like it. So making sure there's clear civilian oversight in terms of local mayors or whoever the appropriate governing body locally is. And there have to be consequences when people like poor George Floyd, are killed by the police unjustly. Yeah. So I think there are steps that could be taken. One figure I heard this week that I do remember is that one study showed that policing really changes when at least 35% of the police force is made up of non-whites in terms of the amount of incidents goes down. Now, 35% is a lot, but in an increasingly diversifying country, that shouldn't be that difficult to achieve in the long run. So I think there are – we can't just throw up our hands and say there's nothing can be done. And I know that's not what you were suggesting.
No.
But I think there are steps that could be taken that would improve this and that have to be taken.
There's an interesting tension or contradiction in some ways that's embedded in American policing right now. You know, one is we've got just a huge – policing is massively decentralized.
Yeah.
That, you know, each city has their own police force. They have their own training, their own rules, and sometimes you've got overlapping levels of policing where you've got city police and you've got county police and state police. And, you know, each of them are, you know, recruited and trained differently. But at the same time, you have lots of police forces which are composed of people who are not from the communities that they're policing. So, I mean, on the one hand, you can make an argument for we should have a police force that is very decentralized so the communities can police themselves. But we're ending up with a police force that's radically decentralized and people are not policing themselves, which seems to be really a fundamental problem and very different from how police forces are structured in lots of other countries. You know, for instance, Scotland has one police force for the entire nation of Scotland. You know, when they were all the police are trained in the same way, and they all follow the same sort of set of regulations and laws, which is obviously it's a very different country and with a different history, but I think it sort of speaks to the ways in which American policing is structured in a very odd way. And obviously the policing is tied in with mass incarceration, not tied in is to put it mildly, the sort of hyper policing that we've seen over the past several decades has been sort of one of the main factors in the huge rise in the prison population, which of course is disproportionately people of color. But I think you're right. We're no longer at a point in which the kind of police can fix themselves through small kinds of reform is going to work.
But I guess
sort of a radical reconsideration of how policing works and what the premises of policing are, and how police relate to the people that they are policing.
I agree with you completely, but again, the optimist in me thinks that the scenes we've seen are such, and the outrage they've engendered across the country and around the world are such that we may be on the cusp of such a moment. You know, if you're going out to protest police brutality and the police brutalize you, it's a very powerful statement about the necessity of the protest. So there may be cause for optimism.
One hopes, although, you know, just the fact that we've been able to sort of link the police violence here to the sort of long history and very recent history of police violence against people of color suggests. I mean, I'm with you. I'm the optimist in me hopes this is the moment that lots of things get reconsidered. I know too much history to have a huge amount of faith.
Well, clearly I don't. So,
It's weird because I think I don't know. We're both optimists and pessimists about different things. About this, I really want to be an optimist, but.
Well, and I just hope. You know, we're it's Friday as we record this, and there are big demonstrations planned around the country, but particularly in Washington this weekend. So I just hope everybody is safe.
Yeah. Well, how does all this end?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because if you look, we didn't pursue this too far, but if you look back to the 1960s, most of the time there are prolonged riots, demonstrations, uprisings. That's not the debate I want to have about nomenclature. But these prolonged periods of disturbances, they tend to last about 5 or 6 days, and we're already at 10 days. So I don't know. Things have quieted down in Seattle in the past few days, in part because the police have kind of withdrawn. And so people are demonstrating, but there hasn't been much violence, and then they go home. So maybe it seems counterintuitive, but in some communities, maybe relaxing the police response might be the way for it to end. But that's going to be very hard to do in certain contexts, especially in Washington, because of the tension there, but the presence of the federal government there, and the presence of the president, who takes a very different view on this than you and me.
The de-escalation of things is you know the way to end this quickly, right? You know the fires tend to burn out historically as time passes and as people start to try to have a more level head about things. But that doesn't seem to be the move that the Trump administration is making.
No, I mean, one thing is maybe it doesn't end, at least in Washington. I mean, I think it may well end in other major cities. But, you know, if you think back to the Vietnam era, there were massive demonstrations outside the White House for days and months and weeks and years. And to some extent, what's been exceptional is the fact that, you know, the past few times I've been to Washington, there've been a handful of protesters out in Lafayette Park with signs about President Trump, but not that many. So yeah. Maybe, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if the protests themselves die down around the country, but they persist in Washington. I don't know. And maybe it doesn't end until the election, and then only if, assuming it's, you know, if Joe Biden's elected. I don't know.
Yeah. This is going to be and one of the things about these events historically, whether it's the violence from the post-World War I period or the violence from the 1960s, a lot of it tends to take place in the summer.
Yeah, well, that's right.
And we can sort of hypothesize reasons for that, but this is going to be a interesting summer.
Well, I mean, we've got the cliched long, hot summer. And on one hand, you know, we've got mass unemployment. We've got people's schools closed. We have people with a lot of time on their hands. And there's clear anger in the country. So that would suggest it's going to continue. On the other hand, there's still a pandemic going on. And a lot of people have probably got infected in the past 10 days.
And the pandemic has already been disproportionately bad for people of color. So
Right. So it may end because people get sick. But then we'll have a whole different set of problems to deal with.
Jeez. All right,
and I'm the optimist.
Exactly. All right. Well,
sorry, David. Right now, people are saying, "When is this podcast going to end?"
Going to end. Right. Okay. So let's wrap it up, Frank. Okay, you got a last drop?
Well, I want to recommend I do have a last drop. I want to recommend a workshop series run by a guy who I know might not be known to many of our listeners. He's a guy in Scotland named David Silkenack, and basically David. I'm joking. David is the organizer of the U.S. History Workshop here at the University of Edinburgh, and the U.S. History Workshop is a wonderful institution that allows both scholars, both senior scholars, but also graduate students to share their work in progress. And this normally runs during the academic year, and it went online in March, and David's been coordinating that, and it's been so successful as an online entity that it will be running throughout the summer for the first time. We've never run it throughout the summer, and David's organized a very good program of speakers and their work for the coming months. And we'll put the link on the show notes, but anybody can come. You don't have to be in Edinburgh. You just need to log in to join us. So it's usually on Thursdays at 4 o'clock our time here in Edinburgh. So please join us. And so I want to give credit to you, David, and thanks to you for organizing that.
Well, thank you. It's been, we've run this for many years, and the workshop obviously sort of precedes me, but, you know, now that everything's online, I figured we might as well, take advantage and make a silver lining of everything. So yes, by all means, if people want to, we've had people recently join from, New York and Chicago and a variety of other places, stateside. So by all means, come I can put you on the mail list. Get in contact with me if you want to do that. So thanks for that, Frank. My last drop, I guess, you know, one of the on sort of the, in the spirit of academic groups trying to make the best of a really challenging moment, both with obviously with COVID-19 and with you know, the events we've been talking about in the podcast today. There's been lots of stuff going on, but one thing I want to recommend is online seminar. It's going to be running in the middle of June by Hotchkiss, which is the historians of the 20th century United States. It's one of the big British historical associations for American history, and they do the 20th century stuff. But they are running a seminar on the urgent past. On Zoom on the 19th of June, but the call for papers is basically now through June 11th. So they're looking for people who are writing about police brutality, mass incarcerations, protest movements, white supremacy, trying to sort of make sense of all the things that are going on right now that we've been talking about today. And one of the people who has been sort of spearheading this is our friend and colleague Megan Hunt, who's been on the podcast before. So I'll put up the details about that for people who are interested in participating in that seminar.
Excellent.
Great. Yeah, there's lots of academic groups doing trying to make themselves useful in all of this, and so it's good to see that. Right, listeners, hope everyone stays safe and healthy, you know, as best you can, given the circumstances. Frank, and you too, stay safe and healthy.
Thanks, David. You too. We'll speak soon.
Bye. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.